Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, or X, or whatever, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available on iTunes and, like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, we have a very busy show this week. We got a lot of territory to cover, and we're going to start with a little stage sociology because that's what happens this sometimes, especially this time of year because Indie Fringe is coming up. And I recently got to talk to retired teacher, now writer and performer, Anthony Myers. He has a show that is coming to Fringe called Reject. And I spoke with him earlier this week about his production. Enjoy. So, Anthony, your show is called Reject, and I have to know, what was the first rejection that you remember happening in your life?
The first rejection that I can remember, oh, golly. In the show, I actually talk about how just a couple of weeks after I was born, birth mother decided to put me up for adoption. So that was the first rejection that I experienced.
Oh.
But I'm not sure that I remember that at 2 weeks old. But I think the first rejection that I can really remember pretty clearly was going into the second grade, where I just did not feel at place at all. Just really felt out of place.
Well, two things. One, Howlin' Wolf said, if a baby cries, that baby has the blues. So you don't have to be a musician to experience that. And thank you for being honest and giving me two answers while I was being semi-flippant right out of the gate. You know, it just happens. So I guess I wanted to ask, so where did this idea for this show come about?
Well, after I retired, I really wanted to get involved in doing a little bit more stand-up comedy. I had been doing some stand-up comedy before I retired and had been fairly successful at it. The plan was to kind of become a regional comic, travel a little bit. You know, I was not getting a Netflix special or anything like that. I was just going to go out and enjoy doing comedy for people. But then this thing called COVID came around.
Mm-hmm.
And after COVID, you know, I was basically in hibernation for 3 years. And when I came out, one of the things that really shocked me right off the bat was that not only had society changed, but it had changed in a very distinct and clear manner, particularly in the way that it viewed older people.
Mm-hmm.
And I experienced for the first time in my life some pretty blatant in-your-face ageism. And I didn't really know how to react to it at first. But after a while, I just did the thing that I generally do when I know that somebody's not being treated well. I kind of got angry about it and started writing about rejection after having done a trip back to the Midwest and got inspired by some art there. And that's kind of what led to it.
Can you share with us an example of a direct example of ageism that you experienced?
Yeah. One of the things that really got me, and maybe this is not so much ageism in particular as it is just the way society works now, but having been a pretty darn highly professional educator for 40 years, for the first time in my life, I got ghosted.
Oh.
And it was stunning to me. I thought, my goodness, you know, I thought that I was dealing with some professional people outside of the educational realm, And basically they decided, you know, we just don't want you around because you're old, and just blew me off. And that was a pretty bitter pill to swallow, particularly when you had been doing comedy with some of these folks for quite a while and had been extremely supportive of everybody in the scene. So that was probably the first time that it really hit. And then there's just kind of an overall feeling when you go out that a lot of times you're just in the way. And it's hard to really put your finger on it other than people get exasperated with you real easily, even if you're moving at a good pace and keeping things going right along. And it's that type of thing that really started to eat at me after a while and just inspired me from there.
Almost that kind of what can you bring to the table kind of aspect?
Excuse me?
At your age, what can you bring to the table kind of feeling?
Matt, I'm quite sorry. I've got kind of a poor connection here, and I missed the last part of that question. I'm quite sorry.
It feels like that's when you reach a certain age that you are looked upon at younger folks and ask, you know, what do you bring? What are you doing these days? What are you doing now?
I see. You know, it's interesting that you should say that because I have a section in part two of Reject where I talk about sometimes the attitude is senior citizens. They've already lived their lives. They have nothing left to offer us. They're a drain on society, and we can just kind of kick them to the side, and we don't need to feel guilty about it. And your question kind of plays into that, I think. I believe that I bring to the table a perspective, particularly from an educational standpoint, that's rather unique. And there are lots of perspectives that are unique. That's not unique to me. What a wonderful pun. I think I bring a unique perspective because I'm also, you know, I really feel for a lot of the younger people right now, too. It's not just about being old. One of the things that that I try to explain to a lot of older people that, unfortunately, many of them don't understand, many of us don't understand, is that young people are not out there surviving in the same world that we were in.
Correct.
It's very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of if you'll just work a little bit harder, you'll get ahead. Well, I mean, that's been true for a lot of people down through history, and it's no different now. But I think what is different is that it's possible to go out now, as you probably well know, and work three jobs to pay your rent.
Yep.
And when that happens, things really get turned on their head. So,
and yeah. I think with a younger generation, with that difficulty, and for somebody my age, I know I am younger than you, but the but the aspect of, well, just do it. It's almost, I'm reminded of the story Ted Williams, when he was managing the Washington Senators, you know, got really frustrated at all of his ballplayers because none of them could hit like he did. And he couldn't explain that. He couldn't coach that. He did to a certain degree, but, you know, there's that aspect of, well, just get up there and do it. And that's something that a younger generation can't understand.
Yeah.
So because of things that have changed.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. And I also think that COVID in particular, and I talk a pretty fair amount about, I cover COVID quite a fair amount in the show. COVID changed people's attitudes toward working. And I was just speaking with a young man recently, really got along quite well. We really hit it off. And we just got to talking about the differences between him being a very young man and myself. And one of the things that he said was that he loved his job and that his job gave him great, paid him very well. He got to work from home. It gave him great health insurance, which now is just part of the pay package if you want to get right down to it. And he was just really doing very well. But he said that if he ever had to go back into an office, he would quit that job immediately. And I thought, well, I don't know. You know, I understand where you're coming from to a certain extent, but I also know that to a certain extent, you have to make some sacrifices now and then. Mm-hmm. And when I say sacrifices, I don't mean go get another job like you can at this time, but some sacrifices such as, well, in order to keep a really good paying job, as long as I'm not, you know, messed with and jacked around with when I'm in the office, no big deal. But, you know, once again, COVID changed that viewpoint. That's one of the things that I really hit quite hard is that COVID changed everything.
Mm-hmm. Did you retire before COVID?
Excuse me?
Did you retire before COVID?
I did, yes.
Okay. Just curious on that.
I take that back. Let me restate that, okay. Matt. I did not retire before COVID. I actually taught about 2.5 years from home.
Okay.
During COVID. So, yeah, excuse me. I for some reason, it just didn't register with me accurately, and I wanted to correct that.
That's fine. So you mentioned that your show is broken down into three parts. Can you give us an example of parts 1, 2, and 3? I know we've talked on 2 a little bit already.
Mm-hmm. Well, part 1 is about rejection as a child and the impacts that rejection have on children, particularly from their own family members. And it deals in a lot of ways with the relationship, not just between myself and my mom, but my mom and her family. Because one of the points that I make is that my dad's side of the family really could not care less who you were or where you came from. But my mom's side of the family was headed up by the patriarch, her dad at that time, who was just, as I say in the show, he was just an absolute racist, bigot, misogynist, fascist. And as I say in the show, with him, you got the full totalitarian package, anti-Semite. And as an adopted person, my mom knew that I came from a pretty strong Jewish background. And when she and my dad adopted me, that caused a pretty big schism between them. And as I was writing about this, it made me really think about how rejection can shape a child's life very early on. And I had this epiphany while I was writing that, you know, I knew how that type of rejection had made me feel from certain members of that side of the family. But I make the point once again in part 2 that, at the end of part 1, that my mom had lived with that nonsense in her face her entire life for having, you know, committed the horrible sin of really being in the 1940s and 50s a very sharp, intuitive, intellectually based woman. So part 1 deals with rejection as a child and the types of baggage that can cause people to carry for a lot of their lives. Part 2 just basically deals with the rejection of senior citizens in the 21st century dystopia. And part 3 is nothing but stand-up comedy based upon all of the rejection I covered in parts 1 and 2.
So we start heavy and we end fun.
Excuse me, sir?
We start funny and we start heavy and we end funny.
Yeah, you know, I modeled it after original oratory, which I used to coach as a speech and debate coach. And my philosophy there was always make your audience do 3 basic things. And of course, these are metaphors, but if you can really pull it off, it'll come back to really do some great things for you. You need to try and make your audience laugh, cry, and think.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody asked me before how to just, you know, give a real quick, you know, real quick overview of what the heck the show was. And the only thing that I came up with, having been a TED talker also, was that it was it's like a TED talk mashed up with stand-up comedy, mashed up with social commentary.
All right.
So, yeah, you're right. It hits to all of those fields.
Okay, you mentioned that you did a TED talk. What was your topic?
My topic then was the importance of teaching high school age kids how to debate and how to evaluate evidence. I was a debate coach for many, many years.
So I have you seen the film The Great Debaters?
I have, yes.
Did you make them stand on the side with corks in their teeth while reciting from across the lake?
Well, that is actually a well-known exercise. You're talking about when they put the pencil in their mouths and speak?
Yep, yep.
Yeah, that's actually a well-known exercise, and I've had several debaters and some extempers actually do that.
Nice.
It really does help with enunciation.
It's funny you mentioned.
My personal favorite was doing a distraction round.
Ooh, yeah.
Where I would just intentionally ignore the kids, and
yep.
You know, I'd throw wads of paper at them and stuff like that.
I did 1 year of speech when I was in high school, and actually a couple of years ago, I was in. No, it was November, December of 20. I was in a stage production of It's a Wonderful Life as a radio play. So we were socially distanced from each other, and we were all masked up until the performance. And wearing a mask while in rehearsal is great training for your voice.
I'll bet.
Because once you take it off, you think you could just, shake the walls. With that, it's almost I used to run track, so it's like running. It's like running on sand or running in water. Once you hit a hard surface, you think you're a gazelle.
Well, let me ask you this: have you ever seen the documentary Resolve?
No, I haven't, and that's on the list. Let my listeners know about it.
Well, the reason that I ask is because two of my direct debaters and one kid who we competed against and then helped out in college are in that movie.
Okay.
And Becca Borden and I can't remember the other one's name now, but anyway, that's an excellent documentary. I highly recommend it to you.
Okay, I will see that, and I will raise you. Have you seen The Trip to Bountiful?
No.
Okay, that's based on a film based on the great Horton Foote's play starring Geraldine Page and John Hurd. And as I was going through notes and talking, when you started talking about ageism, it's an old woman, a widow, who just wants to visit her childhood home in Bountiful, Texas one more time. And she's getting brushed back from her daughter-in-law, from her son. They don't think she has the health or the money to make the trip. And that trip winds up happening. But one of the things that I was thinking about when making notes for this interview and the topic, I was curious if you could differentiate rejection over being told no.
You know, that's it's interesting that you should ask that because in the end, I do a very brief introduction before I go into the regular set. And in that, I make the point that sometimes there are all kinds of reasons to legitimately reject things.
Mm-hmm.
And that sometimes that rejection can actually help us grow and become stronger people, although it might not feel that way at the time. And I think that comment speaks to that. And it's an excellent comment and observation because you're right. Just because somebody says no to you does not mean that you got rejected. It means that in that instance, at that situation, the answer was no. I used to tell my students, especially the kids who traveled with me on speech and debate, that if you don't ask, the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
So, the idea of taking no for an answer doesn't really jibe with being rejected unless it is based upon what I have referred to in the piece as arbitrary rejection, which is rejection based on things such as race, religion, sexual orientation, socioeconomic status, age, things like that.
Right. So we're not talking about my teen and early college years where I just got no a lot. There's different. And it felt
I did too.
It felt like rejection, but it kind of wasn't. So.
Well, yeah, in some ways, you know, you got to kind of pick your poison there.
Exactly.
It may well have been dependent upon the situation.
Right. Well, and I wondered about it because the other thing I wrote in note, this is, and this is of the definition of a rejection. Yours is much more broad than I had written in my notes, but about how rejection is a part of sports. It's a part of auditions. It's part of looking for work. I mean, if you're in baseball and you bat 300, you're an excellent athlete. But that's 3 out of 10. And I think we kind of grew up where not so much the participation trophy aspect of it, but I think we were expected to shoot 1,000% from the free throw line, or you know, bat 1,000, and that's just not the case.
No. It's not. And I really like your observation on the definitions of reject, because when I start the introduction, the first thing I say is reject. There are very few words in the English language that have the depth of meaning and connotation as that word.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, you look it up and it's like, whoa, surprising, isn't it?
Yeah.
When I get to the section on arbitrary rejection, oh, darn it, what was I just going to say to you? I'm having a senior moment here, perhaps.
Now, I'm not going to reject you for that.
oh, darn, it passed. That's okay. It'll come back around. When I get into the show, when I was in the Denver Fringe, I kind of forgot some pieces one night. And the next night when I went, I said, okay, you know, I could have a senior moment at any time here. And if I do, I'm going to go over and pick up that script and look at it.
That's all right.
It actually did happen to me.
I was saying, speaking of which, I know you did this in Colorado. What is anything changed from this show besides senior moments since the last run?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, it has. I'm handling the visual aspect of it a little differently. Certainly the stage is set up differently. The content didn't change a whole lot, but some of the wording changed on it. Probably the best thing that, well, there were several great things that came out of Denver Fringe, which I strongly recommend to people. They really did a fabulous job. One of the things that I really learned quite well was that my comedy went over well.
That's good.
And I was, you know, I don't get a chance to do mics out here very often and test stuff out. So it was like, here we go. Let's see how it runs. And it went well.
Okay. So the show is called Reject. My guest is Anthony Myers. Where can people go to find info about the show and for Fringe?
They can go to the IndieFringeFestival.org, or it's not the Indie, but IndieFringeFestival.org, and they can go through all of the shows. Mine is clearly listed on there. There's ticket information there. And when I get into Indianapolis, I'll be putting up posters and handing out stuff and busking on the streets and all, it has a QR code that you can use. There's also a QR code on the Indie Fringe website.
All right. I have to ask, when you were teaching debate and public speaking, have you ever shown your students Monty Python's argument sketch?
Many, many times.
No, you didn't.
Many, many times. It is one of my all-time favorites.
I growing up with their dad, my kid watched a lot of Python, and the thing I always talk about is how, you know, this is a group that was equally smart and extremely equally silly. And the fact that you get very strong definitions on what an argument is, and then the response is, no, it isn't. So it's just priceless, and it's timeless, really.
Well, I've got a good one for you on this.
Yes, sir.
You've got a moment.
Sure.
Okay, so I'm teaching at this high school at a different location in Colorado, and as head of the English department, I have to show up at this district meeting of English department chairs and we're going to discuss teaching persuasive writing in the class.
Mm-hmm.
And the lady who's running it says, I would like to have a definition of argument, of what an argument is. Well, I'm sitting there beside two other speech and debate coaches, and one of us asked, are you asking for our own interpretation of that, or are you looking for, like, an official definition? And she goes, no, we don't want an official definition. We want to make up our own.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, are you sure this isn't Florida?
Speech and debate coaches just slammed on the brakes right there.
Are you sure this isn't Florida, not Colorado?
Yeah. So, well, it was in a very conservative section.
No.
So, you know, we are trying to talk her into this. And, you know, we all make the point, look, we can bring you five different definitions of argument from five different sources, and you can choose whichever one you want to run with. But none of us should be doing this. We don't write dictionaries. No, she would not take no for an answer. So I'm sitting there, and I'm twerked a little bit because I didn't come in here to waste my time with this nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I gave her the definition out of the Monty Python sketch, and she ate it up.
Oh, see, that's even better than I was going to say. I don't know what an argument is, but I know when I hear one.
No, I mean, I can't remember it now. This was many years ago, but I literally ran that specific definition. And she said, yeah, let's go.
Did you later teach her abuse and getting hit on the head lessons?
Oh, goodness.
Wow.
Yeah. Somebody asked me recently after seeing Reject. They said, you know, Tony, they really liked it. But they said, what's next? And I said, well, you know, I think I'm just kind of getting used to Reject now, so I don't see that going away for quite a while. But probably my next one, if I do another one, is going to be on my experience in education. I mean, you collect stories that are just mind-boggling.
Yep.
But I always go back to the fact of, despite what people want to say about public education right now, the fact of the matter is, for the 40, literally four full decades that I was a public classroom teacher, I met very few teachers that I did not think cared deeply about kids.
Mm-hmm.
And were willing to do whatever needed to be done for that kid to really help them. So anyway, I kind of get off on a tangent when I start talking about teaching.
No, it's okay. It's all right. You could call it the blackboard minefield.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. You know, I can still remember seeing Up the Down Staircase when I was in the 70s.
Oh, yeah, Sandy Dennis. Yep.
Yes, yes. Well, it had a great impact on my life. Because I don't know, maybe it just kind of defined who and what I was going to be later, but I just looked at that and went, yeah, I get it. I really get it.
That was...
Blackboard Jungle.
Well, that was a different. You also, Greece wasn't the only one that had 30-year-old high school students in it. So, I mean, Vic Morrow was held back how many years in that film?
Yeah.
He can shave.
Well, I've had 20-year-olds in class, so, you know.
With or without athletics?
Without.
Oh, boy. Okay. All right.
Out of athletics.
Yikes. No, I was, as a theater teenager in the 70s, yeah, a lot of people did a lot of scenes from Up the Down Staircase. So that was,
yeah.
That was and how about Room 222?
Yeah.
Yep.
I
could never get Karen Valentine's class, but you keep trying. That's a different rejection, so.
I left high school and enrolled at Indiana State thinking I would probably be a theater major.
Mm.
But I got to tell you the truth, and I've had very few opportunities to say this. Once I got into the theater department there, for some reason, I found the people to be weirder than anybody else that I had ever been around. It was like, hey, wait a minute. I'm pretty strange in my own right, but I'm not sure I can run with this league.
as a Ball State,
I ended up going to the communications deal.
As a Ball State theater minor, I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, let me ask you, do you
yes.
have you gone to Fringe before?
Oh, yeah. I've been to Indie Fringe many times. Now my ego is going to swell, and I'm going to be that guy. My biggest achievement was my wife, who is a theater professor at Earlham, in 2019, and now, as we speak, has a show at the original Fringe in Edinburgh.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. So I went in 2019 as a chaperone slash publicity slash vending slash emceeing, you know, part NPR radio personality, part carnival barker. So we got to do. It's a book trilogy, called The Misadventures of Martin Hathaway, written by a Richmond, Indiana author, Kate Glenn. And it's a kind of a steampunk air pirate adventure story. And it's so I was there for book one. My wife is currently in Scotland for book two. And so it's been an absolute blast. And one of the shows I saw in 19 in Scotland is getting off-Broadway or Broadway release called The Shark is Broken. And it is a three-man show, and it's basically Roy Scheider, Richard Dreyfuss, and Robert Shaw on the set of Jaws. And the play is written by Ian Shaw, who plays his dad in the show. It's
what a unique concept.
Yep. For film nerds, it's a major dream.
Wow.
So in a long Commander McBragg way of answering your question, yes, I've had Fringe experience.
Yeah, wonderful. That is just amazing. Are you familiar? I think this might have been a Fringe show originally, a play from Scotland titled Rocks in Her Pockets.
I've heard of it. Have not seen it.
Okay. Yeah, I had our theater director over at the high school when I was there. Saw it overseas and just gushed about it and just said it was one of the most interesting one-person plays she'd ever seen.
Wow.
And
if you've not been the Fringe, there's something literally for everybody, and I'm actually using the word literally properly. You check Indie Fringe's website and you'll see all kinds of entertainment, including Reject by our guest here, Anthony Myers.
Great.
That's Anthony Myers. His show Reject is a part of Indie Fringe. You can go to Indie Fringe's website for all the information there. Very fringy this last couple of weeks. My lovely wife Lynn is in Scotland. She has taken a show to the original Fringe Festival at Edinburgh. It's book two of The Misadventures of Martin Hathaway. I got to go as a chaperone on book one back in 2019. I'm insanely jealous that I'm not in Scotland. I'm with you, lovely people, but I'm still not in Scotland. So there's that. And going in 2019, probably my favorite show that I saw at the Fringe is getting a New York debut. And it's called The Shark is Broken. And it's a three-man show of Robert Shaw, Richard Dreyfuss, and Roy Scheider on the set of Jaws. The three men talking to each other while the shark is not working. And it's written by Ian Shaw. Yes, Robert's son, who plays his dad. And it was just a film nerd's. It's a film nerd delight. And it's a good show nonetheless, because the dynamic of the three men really bounce off each other lovely. So I was happy that it's making a New York debut, and I get to be that arty D-bag that says, yeah, I saw it at Fringe. So anyway, check out Fringe when you can. And of course, Indie Bard Fest is coming up in October. Rehearsals start for some of those shows at the end of the month. I should know. I'm in As You Like It. All right. There's a film opening this week that I hope more people will go and seek out. I believe it's in two screens in Indianapolis. As we know, in the cinema world, there's no middle class. There's no $20 million, $30 million pictures. You're either a gigantic, you know, franchise blockbuster, or you're a little tiny, tiny independent. And this is also the month of August, because sometimes it's a dumping ground for films. But there is one I hope you do not miss from Bleecker Street called Jewels. It stars Ben Kingsley, Jane Curtin, and it's directed by Mark Turteltaub, who is better known for a producer. Going through some of his credits as a producer include Little Miss Sunshine, Sherry Baby, Away We Go, Safety Not Guaranteed for you IFJA guys, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, and this one. This is his one of his films as a director. This is his fifth film as a director. But want to acknowledge Ben Kingsley with a very silly wig. Jane Curtin, who's kind of the Gladys Kravitz of this group. Harriet Sansom Harris, who is a that lady. I went on IMDb, and I've seen her in lots of things, but it hasn't clicked on. And Zoe Winters, who plays Ben Kingsley's daughter, and Jade Kwan, who plays Jules. So, set in a small town in Pennsylvania, Ben Kingsley, with his silly wig, plays Milt. He's in his late 70s. He's starting to get forgetful at times. There is a very uncomfortable neurologist appointment that he has to attend. He keeps little post-its on refrigerator doors to remind him of things. There is a running bit where he will go to the open forum at the town meeting and ask for the same thing every time about street signs and other suggestions to make things safer around town. The one continuity thing I have with this film was, are these daily meetings or weekly meetings? Because the timeline's a little wonky. But we get the idea that there is a group of old people like Milt, like Sandy, the Harriet Sansom Harris character, and Joyce, played by Jane Curtin, who go and suggest things every week. And somebody who's covered board meetings, I've seen these people. So nobody really takes Milt seriously. His daughter, Denise, played by Zoe Winters, she, you know, takes care of his bills and checks in on him, you know, trying to tell him to go see a doctor. And then one night, there is a big noise and a bright light, and Milt has a spaceship buried in his, that's landed in his backyard. And he calls for 911, and being as genuine as he can be, he reports what happens, and they don't take him seriously. The casual honesty of Kingsley's performance is really fun to watch in this. You know, Ben Kingsley's one of those guys, he knows exactly what kind of film he's working on. He knows if he's making, you know, very expensive rubbish and they want him to chew scenery, he'll do it with a knife and fork. But it's just a lovely, honest, low maintenance performance out of Kingsley. So he takes care of this this alien that it winds up being named Jules, although Jane Curtin has issues with that. And it's just a fun moment of he finds out, you know, he's trying to treats the alien like a house guest, you know, talks to this creature, feeds him, brings him water, or them, sorry, working on pronouns, especially for aliens, finds out they like apples, so he buys a bunch of apples, and when the kid at the counter at the grocery store asks why you have so many apples, he honestly says, I'm feeding it to an alien, and so of course, the daughter thinks the cheese is starting to fall off the cracker a little bit more. Sandy, who is the lady who organizes things and lets the town board know that she is doing this, like having a youth connection program where older citizens get to talk with younger citizens. This becomes a plot point as well as a power play for Jules later in the film, which I don't want to give away. But it becomes just a sweet older man with an alien, and one person finds out and another person finds out, and they treat them more as a friend, as a house guest than an adversary. So it's fun to watch the three older actors interact with Jules. There's been comparisons to Cocoon, and I can see that. This is kind of a cheap, smaller budgeted art house version of Cocoon, I guess. They all three of them learn from hanging out with Jules. The other thing that I'm eternally grateful for is, and I'm not really giving away a whole lot, is that the authorities are not that big a plot point in this film. It's more about this little ensemble of players and how they're handling this current situation. It's very, very sweet. The moments I'm trying to what not well up of Milt dealing with his memory loss or his neurological problems, you know, and there becomes near the end, will he or won't he? And I won't give away that. But it's just a lovely story that could have been really big and dumb, and it's small and sweet. And I'm really happy for that. So look for Jewels. It's out on Bleecker Street. I believe, like I said, two screens in Indianapolis. But yeah, look for it. We are in the midst of giant movies out there, and they're fine. And some of them are doing well, and others are not. So, hey, studios, maybe if you make a $30 million movie, you'll get a bigger payout. Just saying. A couple of franchises haven't done as well this time around. You know what they are. So, yeah, look for Jewels. I'm very, very happy I got to see that. We have time for Dead People We Like because we never have time for Dead People We Don't Like. First off, singer-songwriter Rodriguez, subject of the Academy Award-winning documentary Searching for Sugar Man. Being from Detroit, me growing up in Flint, this means a lot. This was the story of a folk singer in Detroit who recorded a couple of albums. The albums didn't go anywhere. And then he wound up getting a huge following in South Africa, and it kind of revived his career. So much so that they made a documentary, and he was able to tour, and he was able to have a second career as a musician. It's a great reminder, friends, that art is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And this was a great example of that. So, but yeah, salute to Rodriguez. Also in the music world that dabbled in film, Robbie Robertson of The Band, my favorite Canadian rock band with a drummer from Arkansas. Besides The Last Waltz, and I've talked about The Last Waltz many times on this film, on the show, great concert footage by Martin Scorsese with the band and their slew of special guests. One can critique that the interviews are very Robbie Robertson centric because Robertson and Scorsese were kind of thick as thieves in the late 70s. They also collaborated on several films together. Robertson was a music producer on The King of Comedy, music consultant on Casino, executive music producer on Gangs of New York, music supervisor on Shutter Island, executive music producer on Wolf of Wall Street, executive music producer on Silence and The Irishman, and I know he has worked on Scorsese's new film, which is coming out in October. By the way, he also co-wrote and starred in Carney from 1980. I might have to go check that out. And, of course, there is a documentary about the band that's also very Robertson-centric called Once We're Brothers. And I think that's right. And I forgot he had the scene that he had a small acting role in The Crossing Guard. So salute to Robbie. And, yeah, check out the Last Waltz when it comes to at least the music aspect of that. And now we shift our focus to William Friedkin. Or as I jokingly said, I had to get it out of the way of because William Friedkin died, I hope Ellen Burstyn gets to yank his coffin in the grave as hard as the ropes that were yanked on Ellen Burstyn while filming The Exorcist. That kind of messed up her back while shooting that. But Friedkin was one of those directors, big-name directors of the 70s. And I think people know him for the two big films, The French Connection and The Exorcist. That's not a bad follow-up. You win Best Picture, and you make one of the scariest films of all time. But going back through some of his work, and there were three films of his that I got to revisit after hearing about his death. Going back, I had forgotten, of course, one of his first noted films in 19... He had done a couple of TV movies and some documentaries, but in 1967, he made the Sonny and Cher film Good Times. Yeah, and I think I'm paraphrasing the Roger Ebert review, basically saying this film wants to be A Hard Day's Night, except Sonny and Cher aren't the Beatles, and William Friedkin is not Richard Lester. So, but it's an oddity. I own it. You should. It's something to behold, especially if you're a Cher fan. That's 1967. The year later, he made a film version of the play The Birthday Party. And he's been very good at his film adaptations of plays. They are mostly isolated, and he doesn't try to open it up too much, which a lot of people critique film versions of plays. One of the films I got to revisit, also from 1968, is called The Night They Raided Minsky's. And it's a inside look at a burlesque show in the 20s. Britt Eklund is an Amish girl, Amish beauty, who comes into town and is told she has a dance job, and what turns into the first striptease. Now, I don't know if that's historically accurate on how this is how the striptease came into effect on stage, but it's a hell of a dance finale, and there is a nice mixture of second unit stuff at the beginning, and then we get a really fast-paced look at backstage shenanigans of a burlesque show. Jason Robards is one of the stars of the show, and is kind of the MC/straight man in this. Other familiar faces include Harry Andrews, who plays Britt Eklund's father, young Elliot Gould, who plays the son of the theater owner, Joseph Wiseman, for you fans of Dr. No. But it's really fun. The film captures the burlesque energy of a burlesque show, where everything is fast, quick, a little on the body side, keeps things going. So, it was fun to revisit The Night They Raided Minsky's. 1970, the film version of the controversial, not really that controversial, play The Boys in the Band, a group of gay men at a party. It was later revived with Jim Parsons for television, for cable, I should say. And then there's The French Connection. Great crime drama, great performance from Gene Hackman. Again, we get permits nowadays for action films, but man, that's a hell of a chase scene. The Exorcist, we talked about. A film that it really jarred people, and I think, you know, this is, we have to say this to the young people. This is pre-internet. This is pre-24-hour news. You had people getting ill, physically ill, running out of the theater. I was reading a post of somebody who saw it, and when the lights came on, they turned around, and then the last row of the theater was a row of priests and nuns, just stunned. So, you know, I've talked about how Jaws scared the hell out of me as a kid when I was 5, and that was just a piece of celluloid. And that's kind of my version of when The Exorcist opened in 73. Nobody had handled demonic possession on film like this. Prior to this, maybe Rosemary's Baby, but man, Friedkin pulled out all the stops. And this became, it's still a high mark in horror. There's a new Exorcist film coming out later this year. Ellen Burstyn's involved in it. So, and I remember showing this to friends in college, and it was a frustrating experience because nothing really happened. Well, I shouldn't say that. We had college kids, so this was in the late 80s, early 90s, but we had been we'd been stuffed down our gullets with the slasher movies of the 70s and 80s. So I think for a lot of younger audiences or my classmates at that time, they were expecting blood within the first 10 minutes. And it takes a good 45 minutes before things really start to kick in as far as unsettling visuals. And when it does, it doesn't let up. So there was that. But I remember having to tell my peers to be patient. His follow-up to The Exorcist, the underappreciated, much maligned Sorcerer. And I was doing research on this. This is a remake of The Wages of Fear, and apparently they couldn't get the rights to it, so they couldn't use the title. But it's a four men, including Roy Scheider, who are on a mission to deliver nitroglycerin through the rainforest in South America. And the thing that the film is best known for is a truck trying to go over a rickety bridge. You can read Chris Lloyd's review of this on the Film Yap, or as he said, it's not really a film. It's just one scene with a bunch of stuff around it. I still think it's tense as hell, and I liked it more than Chris did. But really cool score from Tangerine Dream. This is 1977, so having electronic music like this was still kind of rare. I found out that it was Friedkin's idea to call the film Sorcerer. I thought it was the studio's idea. This was a co-collaboration between Universal and Paramount Pictures. That's how expensive this was, plus the whole filming on location down there. So one of the trucks is named Sorcerer, and Friedkin and I admitted that, yeah, it might imply something that's a companion piece to The Exorcist, and a lot of people walked out because, well, and the other thing was that because it's Sorcerer is a male wizard, and in this case, the wizard in the film is Random Chance. And that's kind of a BS move, and I obviously they probably would have made more money if it was called The Wages of Fear, but going in with a title and then getting completely something else, yeah, not a cool move, and so. One of the rare times I should also say they did kind of muck up the advertising. Paramount Pictures was tired of dealing with Friedkin. He was deemed a large pain and just kind of threw up their hands when it came to advertising. So, but I also think this film came out a couple of weeks after Star Wars. So no matter what it was, I'm also trying to remember, I believe the in one weekend, Star Wars, Smokey and the Bandit, and I think New York, New York, Scorsese's musical, I think opened on the same day. But yeah, I think whatever opened a month after Star Wars didn't have a chance. So, but again, I watched it. It came out on Blu-ray a few years ago, and I revisited it, and it's tense as hell and almost just as good, I think, as Wages of Fear. So look for it. Check it out. It's really well done. The follow-up to that is The Brink's Job, which I also need to revisit because I love Peter Falk. Then there was Cruising. So, again, another controversial film about, in this case, Al Pacino is a man who goes undercover in the Leather Bar District of New York, the gay bars and leather bars, looking for a killer. It was apparently a very fun task to make this in the depths of New York's leather scene. The gay community was protesting. A lot of them hadn't seen the film about the portrayal of gays in cinema. And I think the concern was they didn't want the film to imply that every gay person was into leather and bondage and all that stuff. So anyway, but still a good film of a guy who's slipping deeper into undercover. And is he ever going to recover? Also young Karen Allen, also Paul Sorvino. Hey, Dee Dee. Follow up. That in 1983 with Deal of the Century, which I've never seen from start to finish, and I'm okay with that. To Live and Die in L.A., this was the other film I revisited because, you know, Friedkin had already made a great cop drama, but it was in the 1970s. So we have a really good cop drama in the 1980s. William Peterson plays a Secret Service agent pursuing a deadly counterfeiter played by a young Willem Dafoe. One of the things I wrote in my notes is Billy Pete Swagger. It's the chase, and it's similar to The French Connection as far as the chase and when do we finally get a connection between these two men. And I believe my buddy Eric wrote that William Peterson's Richard Chance makes Popeye Doyle look like Joe Friday when it comes to ethics. There's also a great car chase. Again, he had already made the epitome of the crime drama and the epitome of a movie car chase. And Friedkin said, "Hold my beer, I want to try something." And it's another great car chase. The music's done by Wang Chung. That's also a part of its 80s kind of slick, glossy look. There's a lot of familiar faces in this coming off the bench. Everybody from John Turturro to Steve James. But yeah, it's a really well done, one of the better crime cop films of the 1980s. Followed up by Rampage, which I need to revisit, The Guardian, which I need to revisit. And in 1994, he made Blue Chips, filmed in Indiana, a film that I auditioned for. Yeah. Summer of 1993, I had graduated from Ball State. I was working summer theater, and they were having auditions for extras, for cheerleaders. I was younger and thinner then. This was at Frankfort High School because they had a 5,000-seat arena for high school basketball. And myself and three other people, including Anthony Montgomery, we all went there. And, I mean, there were groups of cheer and dance squads from IU, from Notre Dame. I believe it. So I haven't seen this much spandex since the last Motley Crue concert. And I remember getting on the floor of the gym and saying very loudly that I thought, you know, The Exorcist and The French Connection are two of the greatest films ever made. And the casting director kind of came over and said, William Friedkin's not here. And then, of course, I said, I thought he should have won an Oscar for The Prince of Tides. And she leans over, Nick Nolte's not here either. So I'm like, okay, well, I tried. So we had to do a dance routine and, you know, several moves. And we worked on it in the morning. And then late morning, we had audition, you know, the first wave of auditions. And I made it past the first round. But then again, I think if you didn't fall on your face, you made it past the first round. I was eliminated from the second round, and I believe one of the girls made it to the semifinals. That's as far as we got. And then we had to go back to Muncie because there was a show that night. And I was working summer box office, and we it was a Saturday. We got done with the performance. We went to a one of the actors' house apartments for a party. And by the time the party started that evening, my knees, my legs were so sore. And I looked like Tom Berenger in a Major League. I had two very large bags of ice on my knees and my legs. And fortunately, people were nice enough to bring me beer. And so there was that. And then the film came out. And the dance sequence that they had us work on all day for that one afternoon in Frankfort, Michigan, Indiana, is on screen for about 5 seconds. That's showbiz. And Blue Chips is pretty good. Nick Nolte does a good Bob Knight impression. Ed O'Neill, J.T. Walsh, Mary McDonald, Alfre Woodard, young, thin Shaquille O'Neal. But, yeah, pretty decent look at sports and business. 1995's Jade, that's a bad, fun, bad film that I got to watch with my buddy Laura Jansen. Karina Longworth brought it up on You Must Remember This. 1997, Friedkin made a really good television remake of 12 Angry Men with Jack Lemmon and George C. Scott. Those two would team up again for a TNT remake of Inherit the Wind. 2000's Rules of Engagement, which I don't think I've ever seen from start to finish. 2003's The Hunted, where Tommy Lee Jones chases after Benicio Del Toro. Sounds like an R-rated version of The Fugitive, kind of is. 2006, Friedkin made a film version of Bug with Ashley Judd and Michael Shannon. Another one that's really well done and keeps it isolated and tight. And in 2011... Don't eat chicken wings while watching this. The film version of the play, Killer Joe. Yeah, poor Gina Gershon. 2011, The Devil and Father Armoth, which I have not seen. And then apparently it was completed, but there is a new film version of the Caine Mutiny Court Martial with Kiefer Sutherland, Jason Clarke, Lance Riddick. So we'll see when that comes out. But, so yeah, quite a film career from William Friedkin. So, salute to you, sir. All right, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. We'll talk about some stuff I watched on video, then we'll go around the horn and grab a pencil. My guys over at Golan Globus, they have a tippy-tap this week because somebody went on vacation. If you're a fan of Master Ninja, if you're a fan of network television with ninjas in it, starring Lee Van Cleef and Timothy Van Patten. That's what they talk about this week. From Kino Lorber, there is a film of a theatrical performance. Well, I should say it's based on a theatrical performance. T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. And it's Ralph Fiennes,
The film is directed by his sister, Sophie Fiennes. Rafe wrote, and I shouldn't say wrote, directed and starred in this one-man show, basically doing all of T.S. Eliot's poems about the four quartets. And what's fascinating watching this, it's basically an 80-minute poetry recital, but instead of sitting in a chair, there's movement. There is some outdoor footage of the ocean and the forest, and you know it's more than you see him singing a portion. He sings, he dances, he stomps, he sits. So, but from a directing standpoint, I'm intrigued to see the script. Sophie finds a script of, okay, here you're going to lean against a wall, or here you're going to sit, and here you're going to stomp. And did Rafe do this in the one man when he was doing this on stage live? But it's a series of poems based on who and what we are. I had the same effect watching this that I did watching My Dinner with Andre. I was kind of more impressed with the fact that the film got made than over what was being said. I mean, Rafe Fiennes can read the telephone book for 80 minutes, and I know people would go see it. I saw him do Richard II, so did Mrs. Soucy. But yeah, so if you're a fan of Rafe Fiennes and a fan of poetry, check out T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. So they do that. From Welgo, USA, a film called Night of the Assassin. It's a samurai assassin film that has a Western feel to it. We see an assassin who takes down four guys in five moves, but he's also starting to show signs of wear on his body, and a doctor tells him that he needs to stop practicing martial arts. As somebody once said, weakened tiger gets attacked by wolves. And so the film fast forwards to a year later, and he is just trying to maintain a quiet life and be inconspicuous. Tries to help a woman under distress and gets beat up by three guys. The woman he tried to help takes him in for food and shelter, and he winds up working it off. She has a son that doesn't look kindly upon him, thinks that he's just a worthless bum. The son wants to be an assassin, but the gentleman doesn't want to say anything to him about Einan is his name, the assassin, about what he used to do. And we find out the local magistrate wants to take over the town, and there's the moment of, does he want to go back to his old ways and help save the town or defend the family? So we have some sword fights with supernatural elements. There is what happened. The magistrate abducts this woman's son, so steps must be taken. So as I said, I like when you have a ninja or a samurai film that has a Western vibe to it, and Night of the Assassin definitely has that. Finally, from Film Movement, a South Korean drama called Loners. We are following a young Gina, J-I-N-A, who is the top call center worker. She's dealing with credit card problems from customers, but lives in her phone, lives in her headphones, lives in her tiny, tiny apartment. There are dealings with her dad over the phone about wanting to go to church, wanting to touch base. Mom has died, and dad's not handling it very well. But we also find out that the parents were divorced 17 years prior, but got back for the last 2 years of her life, which included her illness and her death. Her boss, Gina's boss, wants her to train a newbie for the company. She doesn't want to do it and is best left alone. And we find out that Soo Jin, who is the young new employee, it's harder than expected. And her shell is not nearly as tough as Gina's. And as the film goes on, we see if Gina is able to at least crack past that hard surface. She has new neighbors that kind of helps. But it's especially interesting in the last few years because of our technology on top of COVID and how we've all become very, very isolated. And Loners is a really good look at that. Don't want to give away much of how or if Gina will crack her shell. But it has some really nice, sincere moments. And to see somebody finally open up, especially compared to how they were at the very beginning of the film. So Good family drama, also good look at how isolated we have become over time. So look, go outside and say hi to somebody. But yeah, definitely check out Aloners from Film Movement. All right, let's go around the horn, and then we'll grab a pencil and find out what you've been watching recently. Over at the Tibbs Drive-In, screen one, Barbie. That's it. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I clicked. Oh, here we go. Screen one. Is that this weekend? Yeah, that's the whole weekend. Screen one, Barbie and Oppenheimer. There's your chance. Barbie goes first. So there's that. Screen two, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem, and The Haunted Mansion. Screen three, Meg 2, Cobweb, and then they're going to play Meg 2 again. Screen four, Last Voyage of the Demeter, Talk to Me, and then Last Voyage. All of that is at the Tibbs Drive-In. At the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville, it is a double feature, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, followed by Talk to Me. Don't forget, August 25th, Super Monster Movie Fest, Frozen Frights. That is happening there. At IU Cinema, the IU Cinema Open House is next Thursday at 3:30 p.m. Discover all your neighborhood movie theater. Discover all that your neighborhood movie theater has to offer at the IU Cinema Open House with swag, treats, games, and more. I love swag and treats. Games are all right, and more. I enjoy more. And then Friday, August 18th at 7 p.m., start the new school year off right with The Big Lebowski. And as they write on the page, costumes are highly encouraged. This is the 25th anniversary screening. Now, Friday, August 25th, we have to clarify this. This is the 1975 film Jaws being shown in 3D, not Jaws 3D from 1983, which I saw on Long Beach Island, and it was god-awful. Yeah, I think it was the same theater that I saw Jaws, the first Jaws in. So, yeah, the original Jaws in 3D, if you need that, I guess. Monday, August 28th, 5 p.m. Oh, volunteer call-out meeting. That's not a film. That's an event. Learning about volunteering at IU Cinema, where you'll greet friends and meet and get free movies. Tuesday, August 29th, 7 p.m., Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Wednesday, August 30th, 7 p.m., National Theater Live's Fleabag. So that is all happening at IU Cinema. At the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, Friday and Saturday, August 11th and 12th, Dirty Dancing. August 18th and 19th, Friday and Saturday, 2 and 7:30 p.m., Double Indemnity. August 25th and 26th, Friday and Saturday, 2 and 7:30 p.m., 3 Days of the Condor. And September 26th, Claudio Simonetti's Goblin, live scoring of Dario Argento's Demons. That is September 26th, Tuesday night, 8 o'clock at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. All right, grab a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching this week. Hopefully you got to watch some good movies that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. We start with Lisbeth, who writes, rewatched Lehane, powerful and timely as France lives through the same racial and economic inequities decades later. Your Canadian Girlfriend writes, Oppenheimer in IMAX, Cruising, A Moment of Romance, 1990 Hong Kong flick about bad boy Andy Lau dating the girl he kidnaps to escape a bank robbery. Don't you hate when that happens? And I believe, yeah, and I need to get Tracy Forner on back on Film Sociology. I just found out that he is a fan of the film Diner. And I will explain why when I get him back on the show. Allison writes, lots of time at the theater this week. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem, Haunted Mansion, and Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. A rewatch because it's so good. Yeah, that's on Twitter. On Facebook, we start with Nick Rogers, who writes, City of Fear, Meg 2, River Wild, Sisu, Biosphere, Renfield, Hidden Strike, and Heart of Stone. Craig writes Titus. Yes, Julie Taymor's with Anthony Hopkins and Jessica Lange. Go big or go home with that one. Amanda went to the library. Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. Sophie's Choice. I saw Sophie's Choice in Las Vegas with my father. I think mom was gambling, and it was the one kind of not the greatest day for weather, and we went and saw Sophie's Choice on vacation in Las Vegas. I'm fine. Amanda also watched 13 Days. Paperman? Yeah, there's that. I Married a Witch with Frederick March and Veronica Lake. David writes, thank you, Amanda. David writes The Man Who Laughs, Grand Budapest Hotel, and 1941. Sean writes, we rewatched Under the Rainbow. Rachel writes, The Other Guys. It was okay. I preferred Daddy's Home for my Will Ferrell, Mark Wahlberg vehicle. And then David chimed in, honestly, the second viewing of The Other Guys got me. First time I thought it was meh. Second time I loved it. Quote it all the time. Jamie writes, an extremely goofy movie, Back to the Future, Part 2 and Part 3, as well as Guardians of the Galaxy 3 and Jonah Hex. Devin writes Uncle Buck. Doug writes Get Out and Get Under, 1920 film with Harold Lloyd. Four Laurel and Hardy shorts from 1928 to 1932. Big Business, Perfect Day, Two Tars, County Hospital. The 1931 The Champ, Murder Most Foul, and Beauty Shop. Melissa writes Oppenheimer and Friends with Benefits. Jessica writes Psycho Gorman, Shaun of the Dead, and Talk to Me. Eric writes, the first views, Sancho the Bailiff from 1954, the rewatches, Interstellar, and one of Buñuel's masterpieces, Viridiana from 1961. Also finally got to see Hulu's The Looming Tower, which is a great miniseries. Thank you, Eric. Catherine writes Oppenheimer. Guy writes Popeye. Taylor writes Stormy Weather, Tap, Dr. No, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, Part 1. David writes Tell Him Willy Boy is Here. Lou Harry writes The Beanie Bubble. Pat writes Across the Spider-Verse. Kurt writes National Treasure at Beltrace's Saturday Night at the Movies. In the cinema, I've seen Sound of Freedom, Haunted Mansion, Shortcomings, and an anniversary special showing of Shrek 2. I had the week off from work. Thank you, Kurt. Stephanie writes The Exorcist in honor of Billy Friedkin. Missy writes, just started Don't Mess with Cats. Don't Bleep with Cats. Nikki writes Whiplash and Into the Spider-Verse. Whitney writes Barbie twice and thinks she should watch Barbarella, and I agree. Kevin writes Reggie, Imagine, John Lennon, and The Last Duel. Carrie writes Body Heat and Coming Home. Man, that's a double bill. Kristen writes Pretty Good, Lights Out. So Bad It's Good, Sharks of the Corn. With a title like that, I'm not surprised. Mike writes Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1. Alan writes Train to Busan, deemed it wonderful. Chris loved Barbie, Oppenheimer, not so much. Lucy writes Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring, as well as the very first Spider-Man directed by Sam Raimi. Jennifer watched The Last Waltz last night, R.I.P. Robbie Robertson. Brian Hartz, who I need to get back on the show, watched Smokey and the Bandit for the first time. It was more or less what I expected. Okay. Nancy writes, I have a Burt Reynolds note when I'm done with the list. Nancy writes Guardians of the Galaxy 3. Linda writes, got depressed and watched all the Twilight movies. Yeah, I'm sorry, you brought that on yourself. Or I'm sorry, or hopefully that got you out of your depression. Adam writes The French Connection and The Fantastic Mr. Fox. Gary writes two of my all-time favorites, French Connection and Gene Hackman. Most don't know how low-budget The French Connection really was. Their dolly system was a wheelchair. That's right. The stories about the car chase and not being able to afford permits and shutting down the streets are true, yes. And it won Best Picture. Incredible. Yep, all of that. I could never do that. But yes, I get that. And don't punch a priest to get a performance, like in the Exorcist. Garland writes Barbie again and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem. Jeff writes The Doctor Takes a Wife. That's with Loretta Young and Ray Milland. Daniel writes Giant Little Ones, The Art of Love, National Treasure, King of Thieves, Blonde Venus, Take the Last Waltz, Sweet Liberty, Casablanca, and Gilda. Tom writes Glory, Resident Evil, and Safety Last. Al, this, and I'm full of stories today. Al writes, I watched an HBO special of a 1981 production of Barefoot in the Park, since it was on YouTube. And he says, I think the Robert Redford, Jane Fonda version is also on there, but I think that's even more legally dubious. It shouldn't be on there, but I hear you. And I got to tell Al, I saw this HBO production when it first came on HBO. This was my introduction to Barefoot in the Park. It was the first thing I saw Richard Thomas do that wasn't the Waltons. Between this and the Four Seasons, I fell for Bess Armstrong. Barbara Barry is in that. Hans Conried is in that. And I played the telephone repairman at Richmond Civic back in 2013. And for years and years, I was like, I couldn't remember who played the telephone repairman. I know Herb Edelman did it in the film. And I found this HBO clip that Al is talking about. And it was that guy, James Cromwell, who played the telephone repairman. So that's not bad company to have. But thank you, Al. Gary writes, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, Tarkin versus the Vikings, Strip Nude for Your Killer, ooh, Strange Holes, Strange Magic, Holes, Invasion of the Blood Farmers, the original Night in the City, that's the one with Richard Widmark, Strike Commando 2, Bruce's Deadly Fingers, and Tales from the Crypt. Brian writes Bad Lieutenant and Bad Lieutenant Call of New Orleans. God, Brian, that's if that's a double feature. Kathy writes the Divergent series of all three movies, Skull Island and Oppenheimer. Finally, Carrie writes The Last Waltz. And that's what you've been watching this week, friends. So hopefully you got to watch some good films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. Before I wrap things up, yeah, there were two other Kino Lorber films I got to watch. They're recent releases, but I think needing a break from cleansing the palate of William Friedkin, a Burt Reynolds double feature of The Longest Yard and Heat from 1987. The original Longest Yard, the only one that matters, of course. Reynolds plays a retired football player who winds up in prison because he takes his girlfriend, his sugar mama's car, and hilarity ensues. But we find out he was a MVP, but now a disgraced player because he shaved points. He's sent to a specific prison run by Eddie Albert, who has a prison football team of guards, and he wants Reynolds to organize an exhibition match with a team of the cons. And, yeah, this is directed by Robert Aldrich, of course, from 1974. And a lot of this stuff couldn't be made today, even though Adam Sandler remade it a while back. God, back in the early aughts, if I remember right, mid-aughts. But, you know, the Reynolds swagger is always there. You have a slew of supporting players, including Eddie Albert, Ed Lauder, Mike Henry, Bernadette Peters and her hair, Richard Kiel, Michael Conrad. It's still one of the better sports films to come out as far as the footage of it, which Robert Aldrich does very, very well. And a recurring theme in Robert Aldrich's films, dealing with authority and how much pull this particular warden has over Burt Reynolds' character, Paul Crewe. Again, it's a grown-up, bawdy film, and I love it. And I'm glad it's getting a 4K release. This was the next big hit that Reynolds had after Deliverance. He did three films in 73, if I remember. Yeah, White Lightning was a hit. White Lightning, The Man Who Loved Cat Dancing, and Seamus. And those were after Deliverance. Then he made this, which was a much bigger hit compared to those three. Aldrich and Reynolds would work together again on Hustle a year later, which I talked about on this show before, and also got a Kino Lorber treatment. So I'll be revisiting, hopefully, the commentary tracks and special features, hopefully soon on this film. It did get a nomination for editing. I forgot about that. And I think a lot of it deals with the football footage, which still holds up today. And I mentioned my guy Tracy Forner earlier about having him on for Diner, but I'll save it for another time. And if you've heard Tracy and I talk before on the show, The Longest Yard has a big connection with him and me, and as well as North Dallas 40, but we'll save that for another time. And then I've been really happy with Kino Lorber. I grew up a big Burt Reynolds fan, and one of the things that Kino Lorber is really good at with all their films, most of their films, and not just Reynolds stuff, but we get a commentary track, we get more background history. They did a Blu-ray release of Stick, and we talked, there's a good commentary track on that about Florida Noir. And there is a commentary track, which I still need to listen to, of Heat, not the De Niro Pacino film. This was an action film from 1986, based on a William Goldman novel, who I think he did the screenplay, but wasn't crazy about it. A couple of directors had passed through this project. Reynolds plays Nick Escalante. He plays a Mexican, but it's his character's Mexican, but it's slightly not as bad as Charlton Heston in Touch of Evil. But he plays a professional chaperone. He was a professional, not a bodyguard, not a soldier of fortune, but he knows his way with a pair of hands. And we see him helping out a friend, a female friend of his who is under distress. And he gets a new client who wants to teach him how to be, he wants a crash course in bravery. Really interesting bench of supporting players. Karen Young, Howard Hessman, Peter McNichol, Diana Scarwood. The film is also known because I think Reynolds got $2.3 million for this film, and he had to give $500,000 of it back because he punched out the director, and a new director came in. Dick Richards, best known for, I believe, the Robert Mitchum Big Sleep. So a $500,000 punch is reported. It's an interesting action film. You can also see some of the editing where a stuntman obviously did some of this work. Reynolds is in his 50s by the time this film came out. The three one-named action films that he did in 85 through 87, Stick, Heat, and Malone, they're pizza and beer films. Nothing groundbreaking, nothing like... I think it was just to keep Reynolds' name in theaters after having... some health issues and having a string of films that did not do well financially, as well as having troubled productions. And sadly, Heat is one of them, but I'm still able to watch it and still like it. There is a remake of this called Wild Card with Jason Statham, and it still holds up. Stanley Tucci is in it, as well as Anne Heche and Sofia Vergara, and it follows pretty much the storyline of Heat. Although I know the ending of the novel is different, we do have in the Burt Reynolds version, yes, there is a one man against several in a factory, because that's the kind of the standard film climax in the 80s. But it's an oddity, and it kept him going. So, yeah, look for Heat, but obviously the better of the two films is The Longest Yard. Both are out on Kino Lorber, as well as the 1970 film Skullduggery, which is the film Reynolds famously did after turning down MASH. Yeah, I know. Stars Susan Clark, who's always fun and fun to look at in this. Reynolds plays a driver, kind of a small, low-level con man who's out in the, it's I believe, New Guinea, and he becomes part of an expedition where we find out that missing link, we find the species between man and ape. And so we have a lot of actors in costumes that aren't as good as Planet of the Apes. It's directed by Gordon Douglas. William Marshall shows up near the end of the film. But it's one of those kind of, it's because Planet of the Apes became a success, they made this kind of low-budget exhibition. Are they human? Are they Are they animals? And it's somewhere in between. So anyway, but yeah, there's a number of Burt Reynolds films that are now out on video thanks to Kino Lorber, and I'm all the happier for it. And I will try to get some more. So, friends, some words to live by.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's some out there. And thanks for listening, and we'll do this again next week. Take care, everybody. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!